You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.
This is a trigger warning to let listeners know that throughout this documentary, there are discussions of sexual violence, including sexual assault and rape. Every year, at the beginning of February, the UBC Engineering Undergraduate Society holds their Engineering Week, a tradition with various events that has existed almost as long as UBC itself. Over the last 100 years, many of the engineers' stunts and events have gained a fair amount of attention, but for me, there is one tradition that stands apart from the rest: the Lady Godiva Ride. If you were born after 1990, or you aren't an engineering student, chances are you've never heard of the Lady Godiva Ride. Fortunately, in the 1980s, student journalists covered the event at length, as it had become a major source of controversy on campus. Here's some tape from a new show in 1986 that might help you to understand why.
There's been a large amount of controversy regarding the engineers' Lady Godiva Ride, which will be taking place on the UBC campus February 4th. The 35-year-old tradition comes from the legend of Lady Godiva, who rode naked through the streets of her village in order to shame her husband, the mayor, and force him to change his repressive laws. All the villagers turned their backs so they could not see, except for one man, who was named Peeping Tom. Legend claims that he was immediately struck blind by God for his mistake. In the early years of the ride, there was little media coverage and little interest in
it. I was pretty shocked when I first listened to this tape. I tried to imagine this happening. A naked woman riding a horse across campus. I tried to imagine something like this happening now, in 2016, and I just could not see it. But this made me wonder. Just because you can't see something, does that mean it's not there? Sure, there's no longer a naked woman riding a horse across the UBC campus each February. But in the past 30 years, have the conversations sparked by the Lady Godiva Ride, conversations about sexism and sexual violence, have they changed? My name is Eleanor Waring, and you are listening to Waiting for Godiva, Conversations about Sexism at UBC, a documentary produced for CITR's An Audio Evolution of UBC project. When I first learned about the Lady Godiva Ride, a few things became clear. The first was that opinions about the ride varied, a lot. While many students protested the ride as an overt act of sexism, many others, mostly engineers, defended it as a show of engineering spirit, protected by their right to freedom of expression. There were also a number of students who knew the ride happened, but who were essentially indifferent to it. They didn't support it, but they also did nothing to try to stop it. The second thing I realized was that this mix of opinions made it really difficult to get down to the basics of the ride itself. To solve this problem, I spoke to Bill Richardson, the Engineering Undergraduate Society historian. Bill studied engineering at UBC in the early 80s, when the ride was at its most controversial.
The Godiva Ride was basically a parade. who is traditionally held on Tuesday lunchtime of Engineering Week, which is usually the second week of February. And it goes back a long way, at least to the 50s and 40s. For a while, they would have a symbolic ride, you know, with usually a nursing student, and she'd wear an engineering sweater. And then, you know, into the 60s, things got, I mean, more and more daring, I suppose you'd say. And eventually they did have, you know, and then they had someone ride on it wearing, you know, a wig that covered everything up. And, you know, and eventually they just had a naked girl on a horse. And that continued on until 86. So, I mean, typically there would be the Lady Godiva surrounded by a whole bunch of people, and then there was a truck with the Godiva band in it following that, and maybe, you know, a couple of years we had different vehicles and whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It was just, I guess, a show of spirit, right? That's what it was intended to be. You know, it was a high-profile event from the point of view of the U.S. It
was, Bill said that when the parade was at its peak in the early 80s, he was always amazed at the number of students from other faculties that came out to watch. He estimated there were a couple thousand spectators at this time. He also said that there were often TV cameras and journalists on campus for the parade, mainly looking for confrontation between protesters and engineering students. As I spoke with Bill, I realized how inaccurate my understanding of the Lady Godiva ride was. I thought the engineers all watched the Lady Godiva ride, when in fact they actually participated in the parade with Lady Godiva. I also didn't realize how much non-engineering students contributed to the publicity and spectacle of the Lady Godiva ride by simply coming out to watch. Bill pointed out several times that this crowd of spectators was a large motivator for engineers to continue doing the Lady Godiva ride, because it garnered them a lot of attention. I think this is interesting because most of the media coverage from the 80s does not talk about the role of spectators, nor about the engineers participating in the parade alongside Lady Godiva. Here's Bill again.
Quality in that regard. There was probably 1,000 students in the parade.
Wow.
I mean, it was the biggest turnout for almost anything. And you'd see a lot of kids, you know, a lot of guys who didn't come out, they certainly didn't come out to beer gardens or to mixers or anything like that, but they were in the Godiva parade. This was the one rah-rah thing. I'm an engineer. I can go in this, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was the one event that they would go in.
Yeah, people didn't want to miss it.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, they say I was there, right? So,
do you remember if there was a strong response at all from the university?
Oh yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, the official party line was this was a bad thing and should end. But it wasn't like they called the RCMP or anything. they just condemned it.
Right.
But yeah, no, certainly that was not considered. I mean, I think it was infamous, right? So it was one of those things that I think they thought, well, you know, at least we're not boring. But certainly I think there was sympathetic people in the faculty. In fact, I know there were. There were a number of deans of engineering. Like Finn, he was very clever. He just was away for Engineering Week. He would be out of town, and he turned a blind eye. When Martin Wedipole came in as dean, he came in from the outside. You know, he didn't know the culture, and he was shocked. He hated it. I've already thought it was something that was the antithesis of professionalism, and it didn't belong. And he tried to shut it down really hard. And every time I talked to him, he was, you know, he stuck to his guns. He was very principled and really did everything he could to try and end it. But he didn't succeed. And I think the fact that he was so against it was one of the reasons why it didn't end then.
By 1985, the controversy surrounding the Lady Godiva ride reached a tipping point. Students who protested the event faced severe backlash from engineers who were participating. Based on what Bill said, and on archives from the UBC, UBC's student newspaper, I'm pretty sure that 1985, the year of these protests, was the last year that the parade featured a fully naked Lady Godiva. Following the protests, a new show on CITR, called CITR Public Affairs, interviewed members of the Women's Center about the protests and why they opposed the Lady Godiva ride.
On Thursday, February 5th, the Engineering Undergraduate Society held its annual Godiva Ride, a sexist spectacle in which a woman is declothed and rides around on a horse to the bellows of a large crowd of people, most of whom are male, and most of whom are engineers. This year, a group of about 50 people held a peaceful protest at the site of the Godiva ride. However, this group was physically accosted by members of the crowd with snowballs and eggs, while others grabbed their signs and ripped them up. Bill later spoke with Maggie, Danica, Ruth, Meredith, and Rochelle in the Women's Center in Sub. All five women attended the protest.
Maggie, why do you oppose the Godiva ride?
My first thing was that the very question itself, I find it amazing or inconceivable that it can be asked in 1985. You know, it is the final year of the decade of women that such a question could even be asked, but it does need to be asked. There are 13,000 women on this campus, which is half the population. What I see of that's a huge population of very diverse individuals that are involved in all sorts of different disciplines, as much as are men. And what this event does is to dispel that diversity. It brings all of those women into one category, which is sex object. What it is essentially is a small group of men that, you know, about 400 men, which identify themselves as one mob, which bring a woman before them to remove her clothing. They put her on a horse and take her around the campus. For any woman watching that, it strips away all of her capabilities and says that, once again, the only thing you are, or your primary function, is a sexual object for men. So that if you share classrooms with men, they see this event, it again reduces you to a very narrow, false image.
What is it about the Engineering Undergraduate Society?
It's important to remember here that though women comprised half of the student body of UBC at this time, only about 10% of the Faculty of Engineering was female. It seems to me that this small number of women would have made it incredibly difficult for female engineers to speak up against the ride if they wanted to, because it would have meant going against almost their entire faculty. It's also important to consider that 1985 was not too far away from a time when some people believed that women were only attending university to find a husband. Like Godiva, this is yet another thing I have an incredibly difficult time imagining in the present day. It helps me to understand the anger and frustration people had towards the engineers and the Lady Godiva ride. Here's the news show from 1985 again.
There's no way that could be done.
The engineers may argue that they have the right to do the ride as freedom of expression. Do you have anything to respond to that?
The Godiva ride isn't what we would consider falling within our freedom of expression category, because it doesn't just express their feelings, but it encourages those attitudes toward women and other people, and in that way it's more like hate literature than the art that we might cover with our freedom of expression. Our society censors a lot of things that people would like to express because it's harmful. So the only issue really is whether or not this harms women, and I think it's very clear that it does support attitudes which can do a lot of harm to women.
The mere fact that they responded so violently to our protest indicates that they're not willing to permit other people freedom of expression in criticizing their event. So they can hardly argue that freedom of expression is a reason they should be allowed to have the Godiva ride when they are not willing to permit criticism in the form of a peaceful demonstration.
How did they disrupt or impede your freedom of speech?
Well, I guess the most blatant disruption of our freedom of expression was that they promptly ripped up all of our protest signs. One of the engineers walked right through our large sign and ripped it into a million pieces. Prior to that, we had postered the campus with about 400 posters requesting people to stay away from the Godiva event. We did that on a Sunday evening, and by Monday morning they were all mysteriously ripped down, which leads one to conclude that perhaps they were removed by a certain group of people.
As well, too, but there's another part of that, because when we put the posters up on the Sunday evening, one of our objectives was to let other concerned people on campus know that they weren't alone, that it was not a unique feeling to be against the Godiva ride, and that gut feeling you have which says it's a bad thing isn't unique for yourself and that there are other people who support you. And so when all the posters came tumbling down mysteriously, there was also a need to do something public so that people could see that there was support against the Godiva ride.
They did other things during the demonstration that were really shocking to me. They threw raw eggs at the women. They threw snowballs for about an hour before the protest happened. They jostled and pushed the women out of the way. They physically, I would say, abused the men in our group more than the women. And they attempted to block our process at one point. All in all, we weren't allowed to express our opinion on the matter at all.
Well, I saw some...
Later on in the interview, the women also expressed frustration over the lack of response from the university and the AMS with respect to the Godiva ride. As far as I can tell, their opinions line up with Bill's. While the university officially opposed the Lady Godiva ride, there were no official actions taken against it.
I actually checked with the president on this, and the AMS policy is actually a non-policy. They choose not to take any stand against any club on campus unless the action has been proven to be against the law. And in other words, I'd have to take them to court, and we have to decide that this was, in fact, against the law.
Do you think they're implicitly condoning the Godiva ride?
I think implicitly, yes, they are, simply by their silence. I think that there is a strong division in the AMS about support for the Godiva ride itself. But that's not a public view.
And what about the president of the university or the dean of engineering, Maggie?
Again, there was absolutely nothing said this year. It was complete silence. And it's a very good question about how the faculty can allow this event to go on.
Danica, you have something to add?
While covering perspectives of those who oppose the Godiva ride, student journalists also talk to engineers. The following tape from 1986, the year after the protests, features an interview between Michelle Beauregard, a CITR reporter, and Mike Samus, the vice president of the Engineering Undergraduate Society.
What do you feel about the claims from the Coalition Against Sexism and other groups on campus that claim the ride is sexist? Do you feel this is relevant, or do you feel that they're just taking advantage of an opportunity?
Personally, I feel the question of the ride being sexist is not really that important. It's not really a black and white social issue worthy of a holy crusade. It's more of a small question that's better suited to be answered in a 1,500-word essay in an English class somewhere. It's more, I feel, is a personal opinion.
All right, great then. So what about the reactions of the female engineers? Do you think that it discourages them from entering the engineering profession?
Most of the female engineers I've talked to are really quite indifferent about the event itself. You talk to a few and they are definitely against it, and you talk to a few and they're definitely for the engineering spirit of things, but most seem to be quite indifferent about the whole affair. I don't see how Godiva ride could actually discourage the women from entering engineering. It seems more of an issue that if it was important, people would want to fight from within than outside. And on the whole, I don't see this issue as being a major enough reason for not entering the engineering profession.
All right. Last year, protesters as well as paraders were hitting each other with eggs and snowballs, and there were some injuries. Do you anticipate violence to be a problem, sort of taking into consideration all of the opposing groups?
I'm really surprised that people would call throwing eggs and snowballs at each other violent. All the media hype over violence, I think, it's nothing but hype. It's been overemphasized. It's been made a big deal out of. I personally think if you get a...
I think this tape does a great job of showing some of the ways that conversations about sexism and sexualized violence were 30 years ago. While it may be easy to criticize the vice president's opinions here, and believe me, I did a lot of that the first few times I listened to the tape, I've come to realize that there's only so much judgment of the past you can do with perspectives of the present. This doesn't mean I agree with the Lady Godiva ride or discount the frustration of those who were against it. I would just rather point to conversations like these in order to see if things have changed. The other thing that I think is important to remember is that people speaking in the 80s about these things had no idea what events and changes would occur in the following years. For engineering students in Canada, this is particularly relevant. As I mentioned earlier, the most controversial version of the Lady Godiva ride, the one with a fully naked woman, appears to have ended at UBC in 1985. In the following years, engineers continued to hold a parade during Engineering Week, with various substitutes for Lady Godiva. However, at other schools across the country, where engineers also celebrated Engineering Week, students continued to hold their own versions of the Lady Godiva ride, many of which featured a fully naked woman. This continued right up until December of 1989.
Tomorrow is the start of Engineering Week at university campuses across the country. It's usually a pretty rowdy affair. Most engineering students are men, and some of the week's traditional events have drawn complaints of sexism. This year, though, tradition is undergoing some changes. A reevaluation brought on by December's massacre of 14 young women at the University of Montreal. All but one were engineering students, and this year's Engineering Week has been dedicated to their memory. Our social affairs specialist, Karen Webb, reports.
In 20 terrifying minutes 2 months ago, a madman with a semi-automatic killed 14 engineering students in Montreal, all of them women, because he said he didn't like feminists. Now student engineers across the country say they're being forced to take a good hard look at society and at themselves. At L'École Polytechnique, the students who must live with their memories of that night.
To me, this is where everything comes together. If you look at the Godiva ride on its own, you could argue that it wasn't a huge deal, that it was just a naked woman, and that it was not as scandalous or controversial as many made it out to be. But when you consider the ride together with the fact that such a small number of women were enrolled in engineering, and with the tragedy that happened in Montreal in December 1989, I just don't think it's possible to view it as a simple spirit event. It seems to me that it was part of a much larger problem of sexist attitudes towards women that existed in engineering and on the broader university campus. When I first learned about the Lady Godiva ride, I called my dad, who was a UBC alumni, to ask him about it. He wasn't in engineering. He studied forestry, but he knew what the Lady Godiva ride was. Okay, so what years were you studying at UBC?
I think it was about 76 through 79.
And do you remember the Lady Godiva ride happening?
Yes.
What do you remember about it?
Not much, because I wasn't really interested in that kind of activity. I was more concentrating on what I was doing at school. To me, even years ago, it looked kind of childish.
Do you think that anything like that would happen present, like at the present day, would happen now?
Not a chance.
No way? You think that...
No.
Why?
Well, I have to qualify that. I'm not sure if the underlying sentiment or, you know, juvenile thought process that produced the Lady Godiva ride has changed all that much. But what is... has changed over the years, of course, is something called social license. Organizations like universities or companies or NGOs or anything are very sensitive to their public image and their social license to operate. And so when you get stupid stuff like that, that's going to get perceived in, you know, the wider world for what it rightly is, with just some sexist nonsense, then that will affect that company or organization negatively. So they won't do it.
With respect to the Faculty of Engineering at UBC, there are some things that have definitely improved since the 80s. Of course, there's the ending of the Lady Godiva ride. But today, there's also a successful Women in Engineering Club, a group that barely had enough members to operate when it was founded in the late 70s. It's likely that this is partially due to the fact that women now make up 23% of the faculty, which isn't a large number, but it is double what the percentage was in the early 80s. Further, UBC Engineering recently announced their hopes of raising that number to 50%, a goal they're calling 50-50 by 2020. So, the engineers appear to be on the right track, from an outside perspective at least. But what about the rest of campus? Well, as it turns out, we still have a long way to go.
The Sauter School of Business at UBC was in full damage control today. That's after it came to light that inappropriate frosh chants
were happening. Two student leaders at the University of British Columbia have resigned over a frosh week chant about underage sex. This comes just days.
UBC's reputation is taking another hit today. New allegations about inappropriate chants.
The university announced disciplinary measures for those who started a sexist chant during Frosh Week. The chant promoted non-consensual sex with minors.
In September 2013, it was revealed that UBC students participating in the Sauter School of Business Frosh Week had been led in a cheer about underage, non-consensual sex. There were also reports of an inappropriate chant that expressed racist attitudes towards Aboriginal people. For those of you who don't know, Frosh is a three-day orientation organized by students in the Commerce Undergraduate Society. It happens in September of every year, and according to the Commerce Undergraduate website, it began in 2001. The controversial Frosh chants that came to be known as the rape chants used an acronym of the word YOUNG, where U stood for underage and N stood for no consent. Suffice to say, the wider world definitely perceived the chant as, to use my dad's words, sexist nonsense. Soon after UBC's student newspaper, the UBC, broke the story about the chants, it began receiving a huge amount of attention from national media. I was in my third year at UBC when the Frosh chants happened, but when I started researching the incident in detail, I found myself up against a similar problem I had experienced with a Lady Godiva ride. With all the news coverage and various opinions about the chants, it was hard to get down to the basics of Frosh and the incident itself.
So basically, we met up on the very first move-in day, and you had your group already assigned on Facebook, and every group had a different theme. So the theme that year was Disney. So
this is from an interview I did with a Sauter student who agreed to speak with me about the Sauter Frosh, but chose to remain anonymous. She was in her first year at UBC in 2013, the year the story broke about the chants.
And you had your group on Facebook, and everyone was just to meet in the general meeting spot, and we played a lot of, like, icebreaker games and just kind of talked, and then it was time to go to the buses. And what was happening was we were all assigned roommates in our group, and we were staying at a hotel, and then there was going to be a lot of drinking. There was some sort of event, I don't exactly remember what, but it was held at an outside location, and then everyone came back to the hotel. And then there were buses that the next day, there were buses that brought us back to campus, and we did, like, your classic orientation, like, team versus team activities, like, coming up with cheers and playing games for points and all sorts of stuff. And then pretty much the same thing happened that night, hotel, party, and then the next day, same thing, and there was a closing ceremony.
So, and you may not have the answer to this, like, how many students are participating in that?
I think that year there were close to 400, maybe more. It was a really big group that year. I think they said it was the biggest Frosh yet.
Wow. And that's all incoming first years, and then the leaders are people in upper years.
Yes, third and fourth years.
And what made you decide to take part in Frosh? Because not everybody does it, do they?
It's a very small percentage of people that don't, is what I heard before entering. It was kind of marketed as a thing that if you don't go to, you pretty much won't be integrated into, like, the Sauter vibe right off the top of the school year. And that's actually where I made most of my friends in Sauter.
That's the big push that gets people to participate.
Oh, for sure. It was like, if you don't go, you're already a step behind in that socialization process, essentially. The very first weekend that you move in, so...
As I learned more about the Sauter Frosh, I began to see similarities between this incident and the parade with Lady Godiva. Both are designed as this form of spirit-raising, student-bonding type event. And what this Sauter student is talking about here, the desire to belong to Sauter, to fit in, to me it seems similar to what engineers probably felt about the parade with Lady Godiva. As Bill mentioned, the Godiva ride was the largest event during engineering week. People didn't want to miss it. And it seems this was also the case for the Sauter Frosh. Okay, so, the Frosh takes place over a weekend, and Sauter students are bused to and from campus for various events. According to the Sauter student I spoke to, there were a ton of different chants used throughout the weekend, some team ones, some generic ones, but the ones that caused all the controversy? Those were happening on the buses.
Yeah, I was actually on the bus, and pretty much, like, from my perspective, I did not understand what it meant. Honestly, there were like a set of maybe like six or seven chants that were just continually said, and it was kind of like that mob mentality. Like, everyone was just repeating what our Frosh leaders were screaming at us. We're like, okay, let's just keep repeating. And most of them were pretty generic, like, comparatively to the rape chant. Like, they weren't that sketchy at all. It was things like, I'd rather be in solder than an engineer. Like, nothing too risque in that sense. And then the rape chant happened, and honestly, to me, in the state of mind I was in, I didn't understand what it meant. Like, I didn't make that connection, probably because I didn't think that people would actually chant about rape. I didn't think that was normal. So to me, when I, like looked over the lyrics, essentially, in my head, I thought it was about, like, being young and crazy and getting wild. I had no idea. And then when the whole controversy happened afterwards, I was like, oh, my goodness. It took me a while to process that that's what we were chanting, and it was definitely a big mob mentality thing. Like, everyone was just repeating what was being said to them.
This is only one perspective, of which there are many. Undoubtedly, many students were impacted by these chants in different and more severe ways than this student was. Unfortunately, it was really difficult to find solder students to talk to me, and no one from the Commerce Undergraduate Society replied to my requests for an interview. The girl I did speak to mentioned that it is not a popular conversation topic among solder students, even now, 3 years later. It's definitely possible that this is a result, at least partially, of the negative experience some students had after speaking openly about the chants. As I mentioned earlier, it was the school newspaper, the UBC, that broke the story, something they were able to do because solder students talked to them about Frosh. I spoke to the UBC reporter who wrote the story, Arno Rosenfeld, to learn more about this.
There had been a similar story a week before at St. Mary's University out east, and that was actually caught on videotape, so it made it on the television news, and it sort of became a national story. And our coordinating editor at the time, Jeff Lister, was a solder student, and he was aware that, you know, a similar chant had been going on at solder for some amount of time. Frosh had just finished at solder, so we figured that we should be able to find somebody who was there who would be able to attest to that. We spent the day going through social media, and we found some references to it on Twitter and got in touch with those students who had posted the references, and then talked to the CUS and the Frosh organizers, and everyone confirmed it.
That almost seems like too easy.
It was a little bit disconcerting, and actually one of the things that I was really uncomfortable with in the reporting of the story was that it seemed that people were so naive that if they had had any media training, they just wouldn't have spoken to us. So it felt like we were sort of almost taking advantage of their lack of awareness.
I mean, you could also make an argument for them not understanding the severity of what they were doing.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you're talking about, in the case especially of Frosh organizers, these were, you know, 19-year-olds who were doing something that had been done for many years. And the Frosh organizer who I spoke to said that they were aware that it was problematic. It had been going on for a long time, so they had sort of tried to mitigate it, which, of course, is not an excuse for what they did in organizing it. But it did sort of fall in their lap just because they happened to be the organizers the year that we decided to report it. It was my second year at the paper, and I had started halfway through the first year, so I wasn't there for Frosh when I was at the paper the year before. But, I mean, we had been vaguely aware that this was going on, and we hadn't reported on it for all those years, so, yeah.
A few days after this story broke, the group responsible for organizing Frosh, the Commerce Undergraduate Society, issued a formal apology. They also announced the indefinite cancellation of Frosh, and two head executives of the society resigned. The official statement from the solder administration was that they were unaware that any offensive chants had been occurring at Frosh. They made a formal statement to the press that the chants were in direct violation of university policy. They also immediately announced plans for student leaders to go through anti-violence training with the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center. So, this seems like an improvement from the Lady Godiva ride, right? There's a formal acknowledgement of the problem, an acknowledgement of attitudes of sexism and sexual violence, and there are some concrete actions aimed at dealing with the problem, something that doesn't appear to have happened with the Lady Godiva ride. But at the same time, when the school newspaper interviewed solder students, it started to seem as though these chants were not new, nor a one-time occurrence, but rather that they were something that had been happening for a number of years. Based on the interviews Arno did, he believes it's likely that the administration was aware, at least to some extent, that there were inappropriate cheers happening. But instead of acknowledging this, blame was placed on the individual student leaders. Here's Arno again.
This can be very opaque. I think the administration was very quick to lay the blame at the feet of the students. So very quickly, the Sauder administration forced the resignations of the Frosch organizers and then of the CUS leadership. This was a cheer that had been going on for a long time. It was a cheer that the administration was, to some extent, aware of, or they were aware at least that there were similar inappropriate cheers going on and that Frosch was this kind of unsupervised event. There were also other more scandalous things going on at Frosch related to inappropriate kind of sexual conduct, not explicit sexual violence, but certainly things that built a culture of that, that the university, to our knowledge, also had some awareness of that we couldn't report because we needed more evidence than we had. But the university administration, or at least the Sauder administration, was aware of these things, but they pinned it on students very quickly. And one example of this is we filed a Freedom of Information Act request after the stories were published, and they took a very long time to file it. But it was basically looking for emails between administrators in the aftermath of the rape cheer. What were they saying and how were they communicating and strategizing? So, you know, 95% of that FOI request that came back with 300 or 400 pages was redacted. But they didn't redact emails from one of the Frosch organizers to administrators. And, you know, the Frosch organizer was very apologetic and was expressing a lot of guilt that she allowed this to happen, that she allowed the reputation of the school to be damaged. And, you know, they had protected the administrators' emails on the basis of privacy and this and that, but they seemed to have no problem sort of putting the students' emails out there and exposing the student to potential ridicule and that sort of thing. And so I feel like the administration was very quick to sort of bury this and try not to take responsibility or systemic responsibility at least and act like this was a few bad eggs, which we just know is not true. And so I think the way the administration handled it was hugely problematic. And I don't think that's something that we should forget because students come and go from this university, but the leadership stays in place for a long time. And the leadership is in charge of basically imbuing the messages to the students. And so if we want to see change, I think a lot of that change needs to come from the administration.
As I learn more about the controversy of these chants, I came across a similar argument that I saw with the Lady Godiva ride. It is some people's opinion that yes, these chants were bad, they weren't okay, but they were just chants, just words, similar to how the Lady Godiva ride was just a naked woman's body. The problem with this argument is that I just don't think you can isolate these chants from everything else that was happening on campus, just like you couldn't isolate the Lady Godiva ride from the male-dominated atmosphere in engineering. So maybe you're wondering, what else was happening on campus? Well, the first thing that I think is essential to consider is that university campuses are known to have some of the highest rates of sexual assault. Stats Canada reports that over 80% of assaults that occur on university campuses are committed by someone the survivor knows. And the Canadian Centre for Justice reports that women are 5 times more likely to be victims of sexual assault than men. It's important to pause and acknowledge here that these statistics are based on the experiences of cisgendered women, who are by no means the only people who experience sexualized violence. Transgender people and gender nonconforming folks experience violence, including sexualized violence, at rates much higher than cisgendered women. I also want to acknowledge that these statistics are largely drawn from the experience of white women and that people of color and Indigenous people in Canada also experience violence, often at rates much higher than white people. Given the diversity of students at UBC, these are all important things to think about when considering the sexual violence that happens on campus. To understand more about the impacts of these chants on campus, I spoke with Ashley Bentley, the manager of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC.
essentially, when we look at the term rape culture, right, it's essentially the normalization of rape within our society. And I think that manifests itself in many different ways. It goes from things like people saying, like, oh, I raped that exam, or calling, you know, a set of stairway in a certain building the rape stairs, to actually, you know, not intervening when someone makes a rape joke, or knowing that something's wrong and not doing anything or not saying anything. So I think when somebody says, like, it's just a harmless chant, like, it's not. The languaging and the messaging within that chant, although it had been ingrained in the traditions of orientations through the Sword of School of Bitterness and, you know, within other schools as well, you know, it's really important for us to analyze and deconstruct what some of those messages are. And I think not just even within, you know, that chant, but also within traditions within the Greek system as well, within other events and activities that take place on this campus. There's many things that promote violence against the community. There's many things that also just promote sexism or homophobia or transphobia. And so I think it's really important that recognizing it's not just harmless, and that it's really our responsibility to be educated and to be aware of these issues, because language is a very, very powerful tool, and it impacts people in ways that, you know, an individual can't even imagine. I think about when, you know, a survivor of violence discloses their experience, and if they feel blamed anyway, if they feel shamed, that can really affect their healing process, right? And it can really be about a few simple words. When we talk to people about, like, how to respond to disclosure, we say, you know, thank them for sharing, and, you know, tell them it's not their fault. And the impact of those words on someone can be really huge. So thinking about the impact of a chant, for instance, also has a really big impact.
In October 2013, a month after Frosh happened, the RCMP received four separate reports of stranger sexual assault on the UBC campus. The reports came from four different women. Because these were stranger sexual assaults, meaning the women who were attacked did not know their attackers, they are not necessarily indicative of the majority type of assaults that occur on university campuses. However, after these attacks were made public, UBC began to receive even more attention from national media, and the response became kind of entangled with their response to the Sauter Frosh chants. I spoke to two students from the UBC Women's Center, Alexis and Emily, and another UBC student, Daphne, about what it was like on campus at this time. All three students were in first year in 2013.
Well, I think that the media sensationalized and divorced the rape that happens in the dorms and the harassment that happens in the classrooms and the general sexist demeanor of the university from this stranger rape. And it just kind of upheld the notion that stranger rape myth is the only thing that women should fear. It's a man in the bush and not her peers or the men in her life.
It seemed a lot like the university was doing stuff to kind of save face, and I would read about it in the news but not see any of the effects in it, living in a dorm and, like, living on an all-girls floor but never having talked about what to do in the event of a sexual assault or anything like that.
Yeah, it was very unclear. It was unclear of, like, if someone disclosed that they were assaulted to you, like, what you would do, or what would you do if you were assaulted. Like, there was no talk about it with your RAs. Like, it was, in that climate, it was just completely ignored in a way that it shouldn't have been.
Yeah. What about the chants? What were your impressions of that incident?
I had a friend in first year who was on my floor, and she actually participated in the chants. And what she told me was that there was just a lot of alcohol supplied to them by their leaders, even though everybody there was underage, and that it was just kind of the atmosphere that anything went, and that she hadn't really thought about it. And then she came home afterwards and she was, like, kind of upset and, you know, suddenly realized what she'd been participating in when she was just, like, totally intoxicated and, you know, like, not thinking about it. Not that that, like, really justifies that everybody was doing, but I think, like, people there generally just weren't thinking about it and weren't thinking about the implications and what it actually meant.
I think that this is relevant to, like, the general climate of leisure that happens, like, in academics, in the workplace, where it's men who are celebrating misogyny and women are just expected to, like, be silent and participate. And if we don't, that we're prudes or we're this or that. These chants were just kind of emblematic of, like, that culture where men are celebrating sexism and women are just expected to join in and don't really have a say in, like, what happens.
What do you think about the current attitudes on campus now, two years later, with respect to rape culture?
I don't really think anything has changed. I think a lot of the time if somebody says something awful, people just say, oh, it's freedom of speech, or, you know, like, just ignore it, or, yeah, I don't particularly feel like anything has changed.
Yeah, people will tell you you're being too politically correct if you speak up, so, I mean, that's pretty, that says a lot.
Speaking as a student, I definitely agree with this. While I feel that I've seen an increased amount of discussion over issues such as sexualized violence on campus, it's sometimes really hard to tell if this is indicative of concrete change. When I asked Ashley, the manager of the SASC, if she felt that things had changed since 2013, she had mixed feelings as well.
Two steps backwards. I think because of the instances that took place in 2013, that there is more of an awareness on campus that this is an issue. I think that the university has developed a sexual assault prevention team, which the SASC is a part of, and that's a positive step. And I think some of the pieces that have been done around consent campaigns, and this is the first year ever in 2015 that residence advisors have had training on sexual violence and how to respond to a disclosure. So there are small steps that are being taken when it comes to the awareness pieces and the educational pieces, but we still have a really long way to go. And I think one thing that the university is lacking is really looking at the response piece. They're doing well at working with the AMS and with the SASC to address the educational pieces and the prevention pieces, but in terms of the response, it's definitely lacking. You know, a lot of institutions across Canada have sexual assault response teams. That's something that we don't have. We don't have a policy. We don't have a protocol right now either. And honestly, like, it has been 2 years since the incident, and I don't know why it has taken this long. We have a lot of great resources on this campus, like the SASC, like counseling services, like other organizations, as well as students who really care about this issue, that would be really willing to contribute their ideas about how we can work towards creating a cohesive care model so that survivors' needs are met. I think in order to do the job that I do, like, you do have to have a certain level of hope, otherwise you're not.
To put this back in context with the Lady Godiva ride, I think there are some changes worth noting. For example, the resources that Ashley is talking about, resources like the SASC, counseling services, and student support groups, those weren't around in the 1980s. And the fact that residence advisors are receiving training on how to handle disclosures of sexual violence, that's a huge step forward, too. But, like Ashley mentioned, there are still so many holes. The fact that it has been over 2 years since these incidents, and there are still these major pieces missing, I think it makes it clear that these things are just not a priority to the university administration. Because if they were, I think we would see the things Ashley is talking about. A sexual assault response team, a formal policy, a formal protocol. It's great for the university to have a formal stance that they're against sexism, sexual violence, and activities that promote it. But if they are missing many of the important follow-up actions, how much should we celebrate this stance? I think this is another similarity between the Sauter Frosch chants and the Lady Godiva ride. In both cases, the university administration officially opposed the actions of students, but in both cases, there was also a general sentiment on campus that the administration failed to support their stance with concrete actions. I wanted to get another opinion on the role of the university administration, so I spoke with Lucia Lorenzi, a PhD student in the Faculty of English at UBC. Lucia has been on campus for a total of 6 years, and during this time, she has become one of the most prominent voices in the conversations about sexual violence.
I think that change, I mean, I know in institutions, change happens really slowly. Mm-hmm. There was a task force that was struck, I guess, sort of in the immediate aftermath, and it took quite a long time for the document to actually be created. We're still seeing that those recommendations aren't necessarily being implemented. So I guess it makes me wonder, who in the university do we see as responsible? What if individual professors or departments decided to take a leadership role and say, okay, well, there is a task force, there are these recommendations, but we're going to take some initiative and maybe, you know, whatever, talk about it in our first year courses or among faculty, put it in part of our TA training. But I think that it can be really hard to wait for the institution as a whole to make those changes. Because mm-hmm. at the same time, while the university, the kind of larger administration, has a lot of power, they don't always know what's going on in individual departments or faculties. So it has to be on multiple levels that that kind of change occurs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that we need to have the conversation. So we talk a lot about, like, what are the concrete actions that we need to take? And one of those concrete actions is talking about things. So talking about it in departments and not talking about it when something happens, but being, I guess, proactive instead of reactive. I would definitely like to see we need policies. And that's one of the things I know in the wake of not just the rape chants, but also the kind of the string of unsolved assaults that we still have on the campus, that we're waiting for a concrete policy and a framework. Because I think a lot of people want that change, but they don't know where they fit into the puzzle, right? So if somebody reports to a professor, what's their role in the network? Who do they refer people to? And just having those avenues be made really, really clear. And there are, you know, there are issues around tolerance and about people not taking action when something is revealed within the community. And I know, of course, there are lots of, there are issues of due process and legalities, but I think it's really important to say, yes, there is a long administrative process, but what are the small, immediate changes that can be made?
I think this is a really good point. Looking at how change can be implemented on different levels, rather than focusing solely on the role of the university administration, it emphasizes the fact that there are so many different groups of people that make up the campus community at UBC, and that everyone has a responsibility to have conversations about sexualized violence and sexism in order to work towards change. This idea is also the last similarity I have found, at least for now, between the Lady Godiva ride and the Sauter Frosch chants. But in this case, I'm actually happy this idea hasn't changed much in the last 30 years. The thing is, throughout all the interviews I did, lots of people expressed their belief that the university administration has a role to play in imbuing messages to students and standing up against sexism and sexual violence on campus. But people also expressed that it was equally, if not more important, for students to stand up and voice their opinions or band together to protest in order for change to occur. According to the accounts of Bill, the engineering historian, and the CITR and UBC archives, it was the engineering students who ultimately ended the Lady Godiva ride due to the pressures they felt from student protesters and the decreased amount of interest from the broader student body in the Engineering Week parade. And considering the Sauter Frosch chants, I think the student media, the school newspaper, the UBC, played an essential role in ending this tradition by drawing attention to it because it had gone on for far too long. Of course, throughout the past 30 years, there have also been a large amount of apathetic students. This, it seems, is something that also hasn't changed, but it's something that I hope will improve. The attitudes and beliefs that students develop while they're at university, those don't cease to exist when students graduate. They'll likely carry them to their future workplaces, relationships, families. And frankly, I don't want to hear about an inappropriate Frosch chant 20 years from now. When I first started this project, I really wanted to find an answer to my question. Have conversations about sexism and sexual violence changed in the past 30 years? It's clear to me now that there is no concrete answer to this question. Some things have changed while others are the same. But I've also realized that maybe focusing too much on what has or has not changed can cloud our vision. And what seems to be more important than focusing on what has changed is looking forward to see how much work we still have to do.
Statistics and newspapers tell me I am unhappy and dying, but I need man and child to fulfill me, but I'm more likely to get paid.
This documentary documentary was made possible through the support of CITR Radio, and in particular support from Madeline Taylor, CITR's spoken word coordinator. It was also made possible through the cooperation of many, many people who sat down for interviews with me, including Bill Richardson, Jerry Waring, Arno Rosenfeld, Ashley Bentley, Alexis Wolf, Emily Monahan, Daphne Bliss, and Lucia Lorenzi. The engineering chants you heard at the beginning of the documentary came from UBC engineers Joseph Sue and Danielle Black and the University of Toronto Engineering Society. The news clips came from the CBC and CTV online archives. For anyone who would like to learn more about anything discussed here, I would highly encourage you to check out CITR's archival audio recordings, as well as the UBC newspaper archives, both of which can be found online. The music used throughout this documentary is from the tracks Selena Stars and I'm Kin by Colleen, which is the project of French musician Cécile Schott. And the song at the end that you are listening to right now is the track That Battle Is Over by Jenny Hival.
You've just been listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc series. We would like to thank UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund, Peter Doolin, Emily Morgan, Shyla Seller, and Katie Harris for researching, digitizing, and cataloging our archive tape. Thanks to Robert and Bronwyn at the UBC Library Digitization Center for partnering with us to digitize, launch, and host the audio collection. And Erwin at the UBC University Archives, thank you to Nardwar the Human Serbiet and to Madeline Taylor for organizing this project and supporting our documentary producers.
And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.